Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. Today, we're interviewing James Andrew Miller. Miller is the author of multiple seminal oral histories about the modern media institutions that are affecting you day to day, whether you know it or not. His most recent book, Powerhouse, The Untold Story of Hollywood's Creative Artists Agency, covers the biggest agency of the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, representing movie stars, television stars, sports and music icons, and probably enlightens you on an organization that if you knew existed, knew very little about. I'm currently tearing through it. It's over 700 pages of amazing stories with over 500 interviews featuring a number of household names, movie stars, and also some people who were kind of lurking in the shadows behind them. Interesting read and a lot of fun. It was something of a dream come true to get to talk to him after how impactful his previous book about ESPN has been on me, and really grateful that I got the opportunity. So please enjoy my conversation with Jim Miller. So, Jim, thank you so much for coming on Going Deep. Really happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
The newest book out, Powerhouse, CAA, The Untold Story of Hollywood's Creative Artists Agency, is not your first oral history that you've put together. You've put previous ones together about ESPN and about Saturday Night Live to great acclaim. And to kind of start things off, I'm curious, just after, you know, covering SNL and putting together the histories of that and ESPN, what drove you or what interested you about putting together this story on CAA?
Masochism. No, the funny thing is that SNL and ESPN are just iconic brands. I mean, I would say worldwide. And you see those initials and you know exactly what they meant. I think this time out, I wanted to do something where the initials themselves weren't particularly known. So the book could be some like a discovery for people. It would reveal more about the place itself and what it did than, and in addition to what it's like to be behind, you know, the curtain at those places. And so that was kind of like the departure from SNL and ESPN. The similarity was that just like SNL and ESPN, CAA was born in the 1970s and is still very much a part of our cultural landscape. In fact, you know, an ever-growing part of it as well. And I guess one of the things that I was determined to show readers is the fact that CAA is probably more a part of their lives, in fact, their daily lives, than SNL or ESPN. I don't think, you know, many people outside Hollywood understand that. So I wanted to point out to them that, you know, when they're watching Game of Thrones or when they're watching a Tom Cruise movie or a Meryl Streep movie or get into their car and turn on the radio and it's Katy Perry or One Direction, even when they're watching football and J.J. Watt's on the field or basketball and Dwayne Wade or, I don't know, to extend it even further, going into a Chipotle. I mean, CAA is part of all of those things. And I think that has been a surprise to a lot of readers. You know, the book's only been out a week, but I've been hearing that from people. And as a result, I think they didn't realize, because CAA is, you know, somewhat secretive, just how an important place it is in the cultural landscape.
And that's really a big thing in the genesis of CAA was putting their clients first. You know, the Dwayne Wade, the J.J. Watt, the Meryl Streep, all these different movie stars are really the public-facing side of the company, whereas these agents are, you know, they have their egos and they have their aspirations, but they're really dedicated to providing great service, and that's the backbone of what the agency was originally built on. But there is kind of this more secretive side, the secluded nature of the company, and you ended up conducting over 500 interviews, some of them with clients and other outside people. But what was the process like of actually cracking in and getting to interview all these different members and the founding partners of the company that got everything started?
Well, you know, you go back to the premise of your question, which was that, you know, the focus is on the client. So their agents are not used to talking about themselves. And quite frankly, a lot of the celebrities that I interviewed are not used to talking about their agents. The agents are supposed to be the invisible ones. So that was kind of like another judo move that, you know, this book required. I think that, you know, the most important thing when you do an oral history is making sure that you have enough of the key people and the important people to tell the story in an important way. And I was really fortunate that the CA founders, who were still alive, cooperated. And a lot of I spoke to the entire CA leadership, current leadership. So that was really important.
And like we said before, over 500 interviews. When you're conducting these interviews, you know, in previous versions of the book, there people have been frank about some controversies. People, you know, have their unique perspectives that they take to different, sometimes volatile situations. What was the process like? Were people reluctant to speak? Was there some kind of snowball effect as once you got a certain number of people on board and have talked to a certain number, you kind of say, hey, well, we're putting this story out anyways. You can either be a part of it or sit out. What was that process like?
Well, I think that was true. Look, initially, CA didn't want to participate in the current regime. And I think that once they realized that the book was going to come out, it behooved them to participate and be involved. And I would like to think that they are glad that they did. You know, every interview is, you don't just get to interview somebody just because somebody else did. I mean, now, I think that there were people who, celebrities, for instance, who had read, you know, the previous books, and I think that kind of gave me some wind at the back in terms of a request for them. But, you know, they don't have to do this. It's not like they're plugging. They usually do interviews because they're plugging a TV show or movie of theirs. There's no upside to that. I wasn't paying them. And it's taking their time and making them remember things and going back through time. So, you know, I'm enormously grateful for the fact that I had the participation that I did. I also believe that, you know, once they started talking, they started to reflect on things. And, you know, you kind of lose perspective sometimes, or you don't remember things in a way that, you know, because you were thinking about your own career or something. So I was struck by how many celebrities wound up really talking about how much they valued their agents and the impact that the agents had on their careers, which is, you know, again, something you don't find every day.
Yeah, and it was interesting, some of them even talking about how closely they regarded these agents and how important they were in helping them make decisions that were vital for the success of their careers. And it's sometimes painted as the agent is always the one trying to shove projects down the throats of their clients, but oftentimes it was coaxing them to do something that they'd know would really align with their strengths and be honest about some of their weaknesses in where they were directed to move.
Right, and just think, I mean, you know, to your point, just think about some of the examples in the book. I mean, I can't imagine Ferris Bueller's day off without Matthew Broderick. Yet, you know, he, you know, initially didn't want to do it. I mean, Cher didn't want to do Moonstruck. Ron Meyer, you know, kind of, as she said to me, tricked me into it. Sarah Jessica Parker didn't want to do Sex and the City, but, you know, Kevin Huvane prevailed upon her to do it. Nicole Kidman, who won the Academy Award for Best Actress for The Hours, initially didn't want to do that. So I think that's... you know, those wind up being kind of fun stories in the book that really show you, you know, the value of a relationship that's based on trust.
Absolutely. And another thing that we always talk about on this show is we like to cover startups and other companies in different phases of their life cycle. And CAA's kind of hit this maturity point now after decades of being in the business, but you recount it from the early startup days when they're working out of someone else's office and not taking a paycheck through the development of when they become a recognized player on the scene and their kind of different value add that gets them some doors open and have the discussions with other clients. And I'm curious, as you were covering, you know, these different decades of the company, were there any points that particularly struck you as a revelation for the company or something that was really, as you were putting the story together, you were saying, this is really a quintessential moment in the life cycle of CAA?
Well, look, there were probably two. One was when they broke off from William Morris and started the agency in 1975. I love startup stories myself. I mean, my favorite parts of the SNL book and the ESPN book were, you know, those origin stories. I think that's fascinating. And I love disruption and chronicling disruption. And, you know, in all three cases, the creation of these entities were highly disruptive to, first, the world of comedy with SNL, second, the world of broadcast, of sports television, and then the entertainment world with ECA. So I think that the early years were a lot of fun to report on. The second and more obvious moment for CA was in 1995 when Michael Ovitz, Ron Meyer, and Bill Haber left, because undergoing that kind of thrombosis in, you know, at that time in the agency's history was incredibly, incredibly eventful. And there were myriad of ways in which things could have shaken out. And you know, you start to, I felt a real obligation as a storyteller to explain to the reader why certain things happened and how they happened. And then you get to look at, you know, the consequences of them happening that way. And nothing was preordained. There was no, you know, particularly in 1995, because there was no succession plan. So you have, you know, what's arguably the most successful talent agency in Hollywood at that time. There, the three people, you know, the founders and the leaders of the company, all three leave in the same year. And it's crazy. I mean, no succession plan. And by the way, certain people really felt entitled to take over. And that didn't necessarily wind up being the case. So it was very Shakespearean and very, very interesting to watch. And there was personality and generational forces at work. And so I found that time particularly compelling.
Absolutely. And another thing, as you paint this picture, and what you've actually done with the ESPN book is, since writing it and since it's been out in the public, you've really established yourself as an expert on ESPN. You've been interviewed when Bill Simmons left ESPN and other things have happened with that company. And I'd imagine similarly, as the years go by, you're going to be asked for your commentary on CAA. But as things stand right now with the release of this book and CAA kind of moving into a different stage, I'm curious if you have any expectations or projections for the future for what the company will look like. It's certainly not in the hegemonic status that it was in previous decades, with much more competition coming at it. But I'm also curious, maybe if you'd care to speculate on the technological side of things. There's kind of this movement in a lot of different industries across the world of a decentralization, the reduction of the value of the middleman, facilitating different deals, and a lot more artists kind of striking out on themselves with different platforms. I'm curious what you see the future holding for CAA and other agencies around the world.
Well, look, there's many different approaches. I think that one of the things that we see with CAA now, and particularly with WME, IMG, is they're now principally owned by private equity firms. And that can be both a blessing and a curse. I think that, you know, the interesting thing is it gives them a lot more financial wherewithal, plus financial insights and, you know, advice that they wouldn't normally have. And I think that when you look at the changing natures of the movie business and the television business, I mean, one of the things I was able to report in the book is that in 2015, CAA Sports, which just started in 2006, became the largest revenue producer inside the agency. And that speaks directly to, you know, the heart of your question, which is, you know, this changing landscape. So I think that, you know, the short answer is there's a lot up for grabs, and it's a very, very competitive landscape. So CAA did not kind of enjoy the total dominance that it enjoyed in the early 90s and late 80s. And I think that as a result, there's much more at stake. The numbers are much bigger in terms of the dollars involved. I mean, WME just bought the UFC for $4 billion. They bought IMG for $2.4 billion. I mean, these are things that we haven't seen in the agency world up to now. And so in terms of the future, I think that it's a very uncharted path. And particularly when you think about whether or not CAA and or WME will wind up being a public company. If these are public companies, that has a different, that obviously means different things for them as well. So, you know, I think it's going to be a very, very dynamic world to keep abreast of.
Absolutely. High stakes. And I love the notion of the uncharted path of what's coming forward. Speaking of charting a path, though, and we'll start wrapping up here after this question, when it comes to the genre of the oral history book, I think you'd agree we're not the first person to ever do an oral history, but you have been genre defining with the previous two books and now the third, leading away and giving birth to a number of copycats or imitators or emulators. What would you say, having produced three of these now, is key or paramount to producing a great oral history?
Well, I think that, look, you have to have participation. You have to have, you know, the key people talking and being willing to talk on the record, because that's what an oral history is. You have to have the sense that even though some people may not think it's the case, it's probably oftentimes much harder to do than just simply writing a book. That's not to say that, I mean, I've written books that aren't, you know, a book that isn't an oral history, but and that's tough. But my only point is, it can be very, very demanding beyond this book took me 3 years. I could have done it in less than two if I just sat down at the keyboard and banged out a book. So there's that level of difficulty that I think people sometimes don't associate with an oral history. And then the third thing is, that's probably one of the reasons why, you know, some people have a tendency in reviews to say, well, I don't really understand, this one said this and this one said that. That's kind of confusing. Well, you know, look, one of Freud's definitions of maturity was the ability to handle ambiguity. And I don't believe in shoving my own personal thought down the throat of a reader just for the sake of doing it. And if it winds up being that there are conflicting accounts or conflicting agendas, that's another level of relevant and revelatory information for the reader to take on and to encounter. So it doesn't bother me at all.
That's very enlightening, Jim, and I appreciate that. Want to make sure people know where to get the book and where to connect with you in the digital world. Where can we point them to if they want to learn more?
Thanks so much. Well, I guess Twitter, first and foremost, I'm at Jim Miller, and I love communicating on Twitter. And there's a Facebook page, an author Facebook page, James Andrew Miller, and I try and be really responsive to people who write in about that. I just started that like a month ago, and it's been fascinating. I hadn't thought about doing it before, but my publisher asked me to do it, and that's been a lot of fun. Great way to engage people. And then I have a website, www.jamesandrewmiller.com.
Fantastic. That'll be linked to in the show notes at goingdeepwithaaron.com/podcast. Make sure you check it out. And make sure you check out the book, Powerhouse, The Untold Story of Hollywood's Creative Artists Agency. I've been really enjoying it. Haven't quite gotten all the way through it because it's 700 pages here, Jim.
But it's a quick read.
Excited to wrap it up.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And thanks for the thoughtfulness of the questions.
Absolutely. We just went deep with Jim Miller. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day.
Hey everyone, hope you enjoyed today's episode. Make sure you hit that subscribe button if you haven't already done so, and connect with me and Jim on Twitter. We've linked Jim's info in the show notes at goingdeepwithaaron.com. I'm at AaronWatson59 on Twitter, and would love to continue the conversation if you want to learn more about the book or read it and have any reactions. It is big, it is substantial, but it is mind expanding without a doubt. We've got some other great episodes coming down the pipe in the next few weeks. Among those, we've got a conversation about connection and networking with Larry Gioia. And additionally, we've got a enlightening conversation with Ray Gastiel, a city planner. Personally, I didn't know anything about city planning, how it worked, what goes into that job. So it was an insightful conversation and one that I'm excited to share with you. So keep listening and tuning into Going Deep with Aaron Watson.